Mr. Schlafly is general counsel for the Association of American Physicians and Surgeons.
Thank you very much, Jane. It's a great pleasure to be here today and be with all of you fine people. I'm going to discuss three aspects of the litigation epidemic, and it goes from easier to harder, inspired by Richard Feynman's lectures, which I was reminded of as someone talked about Caltech this morning. And he had this skill of starting out his lectures very simply, and then it got extremely difficult till by the end none of the students understood anything. And hopefully maybe I'll run out of time so we won't have to tackle the most difficult parts of this issue. But it's relatively easy to describe the litigation epidemic. And it's not going to be very difficult persuading people that there is a litigation crisis. So that's the easy part. What gets more difficult is then to understand the fallout from the litigation epidemic, all the distortions that causes. They're not always easy to recognize, so we'll get to that. And then the most difficult part today is to talk about how to solve the epidemic, what to do about it, and that's very difficult. So we'll suggest and discuss certain solutions to try to solve the epidemic. But let's start just by describing the epidemic, and that's easy and fun. And I figure the best way to do that is just to initially talk about some of the warnings that you see on everyday items. Go back to the hotel room. Look at some of the everyday things you have and look at the warning labels that are on them, disclaimers. And I've come up with a few disclaimers here that are pretty remarkable. Here's the warning that's placed on a fireplace log. Pull out a fireplace log, you see the following warning on it. Caution, risk of fire. They're afraid they're going to be sued. They're afraid someone's going to light it, it's going to burn, they're going to burn themselves, they're going to get sued. Here's the warning on Marks and Spencer bread pudding. Warning. Product will be hot after heating. Here's a warning label on a pair of shin guards manufactured for bicyclists. Shin guards that bicyclists put on. Shin pads cannot protect any part of the body they do not cover. Company is afraid they're going to get sued. Maybe they were sued. They probably were sued. Somebody fell over on their bike. They were wearing the shin guard, and they broke their elbow. They sued the company that the shin guard didn't protect their elbow. This disclaimer is on Nitol nighttime sleep aid. Warning, may cause drowsiness. This warning can be found on a sharpening stone. Knives are sharp. Here's a common baby strolling disclaimer you see on a baby stroller. It's common. Remove child before folding. Yeah, probably, yeah, right. Okay, one more here. You know those nice sun shields that people put on their dashboard to keep it from getting hot? They leave their car in the hot sun, put that on their dashboard so it doesn't overheat. Look at it, you'll see a disclaimer on it. Do not drive with sun shield in place. Actually, There is an army of attorneys out there suing these companies. If anybody gets hurt with any of these products, they will sue the company. They will sue anybody and everybody. There was, if you remember that tragic bar that went up in flames in Connecticut, I guess it was Rhode Island, actually, about a year and a half ago.
Coconuts,
yeah, 100 people died. Anheuser-Busch, I knew someone at Anheuser-Busch that said, you just wait, we're going to get sued for that thing, because there was Anheuser-Busch name was on the bar, and nothing to do with it, but the beer was sold at the bar, and they said, we'll get sued, and they did get sued. Everybody gets sued. They sue everybody. Everybody. Here are a few sample lawsuits. And this could go on and on. I'll just give you a few examples. Here in California, in San Carlos, a man walks into a library with a 50-pound Labrador dog. And he's in the Escondido Public Library with this huge dog. Did you hear about this? The dog was attacked by a 12-pound feline mascot known as the library cat that hung around the library. And the cat attacked his dog. And he sued the library for $1.5 million because his huge dog was attacked by the library's cat. $1.5 million. All right. At the University of Idaho, there was a student who was mooning people from his third floor room. And one day, the window gave way, and he fell out of the building. And guess what? He sued the university for not providing a safe environment for him. And then there are the McDonald's, the people who eat and drive while eating McDonald's. All right, and here's a story about a guy who spilled his milkshake all over himself, and then while he's trying to clean up the milkshake, he ran into somebody else. The person he ran into sued McDonald's because he said McDonald's had not warned the driver not to eat and drive at the same time. I'll get to the other McDonald's case a little bit later. But all right, so we've got this system now where everybody is suing everybody, and it's basically become a big wealth redistribution system. Whereas juries say, well, this person has more money than this person, so let's just redistribute the wealth from person A to person B, even things out. And if you have more money, you don't want to be in a courtroom in front of a lot of these juries. You've got insurance companies defending these cases, but they don't always do such a great job because the insurance policies have limits on them. So they come in and they say, yeah, we'll defend you. But they know that if it's a $10 million judgment, $5 million judgment, they're only going to have to pay the maximum of their policy. So a lot of times, they're really not so good in defending these things. Whereas on the other side of the case, on the plaintiff's side, you got these contingency fee attorneys who are going to get a third or more of whatever is recovered. So they're loaded for bear in these cases. And they got training programs, and they got experts. And, I mean, this is their lifeblood, these things. And they've got the game perfectly figured out, and they make sure that they place the right jurors on that jury. And that's really the name of the game, is selecting the right jurors to serve on these juries. And the defendants are not very good at picking that. The plaintiffs are great at it. They've got their courses. They got all the tricks picked out. The latest thing that's circulated by the plaintiffs' bar is to keep religious people off of juries. That's the latest plaintiffs' trick. Because they found that people who are religious tend to hold the plaintiff responsible for their misconduct. So the people who are trying to eat and drive at the same time, they find that the jurors who have a religious background or have moral values, whatever, they'll say, you shouldn't be doing that. I'm not going to award you anything. And so the plaintiff's attorneys will screen those people off the jury. If you're on the defense side, what you want are conservative jurors. You want people who are frugal with their own money and they're frugal with other people's money. They're not going to throw around a $6 million judgment for something that's ridiculous. it's not easy to pick those people out. If you've ever selected a jury, and I did 6 months ago, it's not an exact science. You look at people and you try to size them up. You know, is this person going to give a big award here? Is this person going to listen to logic? Is this person going to listen to reason? Or is this person just going to try to take from the wealthier person in the case and give it to the less wealthy person? So there's a whole art to this, picking the jury. Then there's picking the experts. That's another way this game is played. And it's another big scam. All the so-called experts out there running around who are all too happy to testify in these cases and exaggerate, make things up, make a little injury look like a huge injury. I mean, this is a cottage industry now. The experts who can be hired by plaintiffs as hired guns to go in and try to inflate an award. And there are a lot of professors and other people who are all too happy to get some fat fee to testify as an expert for thousands of dollars in one of these malpractice cases or personal injury cases and claim that there is some huge injury. Now, if you look at the most famous McDonald's case, which was the woman who got the coffee and then gets in her car and she's driving along, she spills the coffee over herself and she burns herself with the coffee, and then she sues McDonald's for selling hot coffee. And she got a compensatory award of $200,000 and a punitive damage award of $2.7 million for spilling coffee on herself. She was trying to put cream and sugar in while driving away in the car. Now, she wasn't actually driving the car. She was a passenger in the car, but she's trying to put cream and sugar in the coffee, and she gets an award of almost $3 million for her trouble. Now, that was reduced, but it was reduced to like $500,000, which is still a huge sum of money. And the way that case was won was, first of all, they picked a jury that was very pro-plaintiff, that was looking for a way to stick it to the big corporation. And they beat McDonald's with the experts. The plaintiffs did a much better job on the experts than McDonald's did. The McDonald's experts came in, and one testified that he knew that McDonald's coffee sometimes caused serious burns, but he didn't see it as his job to consult burn experts about that issue. Of course, something's hot, it can burn you. And he testified that McDonald's did not plan to reduce the temperature of its coffee because he said, quote, there are more serious dangers in restaurants, close quote. They put their time into something else, which is probably true. I mean, it's probably just testified truthfully. Well, one of the jurors was quoted afterwards as saying that expert showed, quote, a callous disregard for the safety of the people, close quote. All right, well, they had a second expert come in for McDonald's, and he said, yeah, there are a few people who get burned by coffee, but it's statistically insignificant when you consider how many people order coffee at McDonald's. It's not a very large number. Well, the jurors took offense at that, too. And they quoted one of the jurors afterwards as saying, there was a person behind every number, and I don't think the corporation was attaching enough importance to that. Basically, McDonald's lost in the way that jury was selected. Another juror was quoted after the case, McDonald's was not taking care of their customers, close quote. Yeah, it's McDonald's job to take care of their customers and make sure they don't drive or sit in a car while they're trying to put cream and sugar in their coffee. Meanwhile, the plaintiff's experts, these people, I mean, they're taught, and they come in and they really deliver the goods. Supposedly, the plaintiffs had a scholar in thermodynamics testify at the trial about human skin burns. went on and on about temperatures and how they cause burns and everything. I mean, he probably made more money for his time than anything else he's done, you know, his entire life. And that's part of the problem. There's big money in these cases. There's a case that was just decided by the U.S. Supreme Court where the plaintiff's bar now wants to sue foreign companies for conduct of those foreign companies in foreign countries. And now, so now we're going to export our litigation crisis to the rest of the world. And these plaintiffs complain that these companies were fixing the prices of vitamins that were sold outside the United States. And they were suing here in the United States about the prices of vitamins being sold outside the United States. These other countries came into the Supreme Court. Japan filed a brief. Germany filed a brief. And they said, this is nuts. You know, don't export your litigation problem to our countries, please. Please. You know, we got our own rules about how companies can price their goods and everything. You know, we don't want our companies to be subject to suit in the United States for the way they sell goods in Germany and Japan. Well, the plaintiffs got some series of economists to file a brief saying, oh, it's very important that American antitrust laws and their treble damages and all these, you know, attorney's fees and all that gets applied all around the world. That's very important. They got all these economists to sign on to that. Ridiculous. Fortunately, the Supreme Court held against the plaintiff's bar, which is unusual, but they put a stop to that in that particular case. All right, well, what happens in these cases is not just that money is shifted from the wealthy company to the plaintiff. And of course, most of it ends up going to the attorneys. I'll get to that in a second. But it's also, there's more fallout to it, which in the case of McDonald's, not only did they lose $500,000 plus all their attorney's fees, but they also reduced the temperature of their coffee. So now you can't get hot coffee at McDonald's anymore. So look, you know, we're not going to, hey, we wanted to give our customers hot coffee, but, you know, if we're going to get sued over this, hey, that's an easy choice for us. Nobody's getting hot coffee anymore. Reduce the temperature of their coffee. They knocked it down, I think it was 20 or 30 degrees. Now everybody suffers. All right, here are some of the numbers. Tort costs were $12 per citizen in 1950, but rose to $721 per citizen by 2001. So, in 50 years, it went from $12 per citizen to $721 per citizizen. 2001, tort costs were $205 billion, which is 2% of our gross domestic product. If you look at medical malpractice costs rose by 1,642%, four times faster than medical costs themselves increased since 1975. And medical costs have been going up a lot, but malpractice going up four times the rate. The tort system is one of the most inefficient wealth redistribution systems known to man. Only 22% of tort awards for economic loss actually go to the plaintiff. 24% of the award is for this nebulous pain and suffering. But more than half of the money never gets to the plaintiff. Where does it go? A lot of it goes to the plaintiff's attorney, of course. Defense attorneys incur costs. And then there are these huge administrative costs, fees, experts, court costs, reporters, so on. So if you want to redistribute wealth, just increase the tax rate. It's more efficient. Tort system litigation is extremely inefficient. Most people don't realize that a lot of these cases, in fact, most cases that are brought for personal injury or malpractice are done by the attorney paying a referral for that case. probably doesn't realize that. This is a business whereby if someone is injured and they go to an attorney, the attorney can then refer that case to someone who specializes in this and get paid a fee for that referral without ever telling the client. You can't do that in any other business. You can't do that in medicine, for example. If you go and see a doctor and the doctor says, you got a problem, I want you to see another doctor, doctor can't get paid a referral fee for that. It corrupts the system. It means the doctor's referring to another doctor simply because he's getting a fee. But in these malpractice cases, the attorneys have the system rigged where they can pay referrals. They can pay for these cases. And that's what's going on. Most cases that are brought now are brought by the attorney who brings it pays a referral fee to the person who found the case. And that's why you'll see that attorneys who are not even in the field of personal injury and malpractice will defend the system because a lot of them are getting referrals on the cases that they pass on to other attorneys. Now, some states have limits on how much the attorneys can charge, how much they can get as part of the contingency, but what there are not limits on are the expenses that the attorney can rack up. So what will happen when a client comes into the attorney's office with a personal injury or malpractice case, the attorney will tell him, well, we're going to hire all these experts and we're going to hire all these doctors. And some of these firms actually have doctors who work for the law firm now. They're full-time on the staff of the law firm. And the attorney said, well, we're going to run up $50,000 to $100,000 in expenses on your behalf. And the client thinks, oh, that's nice of the law firm to do that. What the law firm is doing is just take that money right off the top, and it gets around the caps on the contingency fees that some states have passed to try to control the abuse. All right, what are some of the other distortions that are caused by the litigation crisis? Well, one distortion is that in the field of hospitals, whenever a doctor at a hospital starts to point out quality of care issues to the hospital immediately fears malpractice cases, and the hospital will get rid of that doctor, will fire the doctor. It's the whistleblower problem, but it's particularly bad in this area of malpractice. And I have a number of clients who have reported quality of care problems. Patients are not being taken care of properly, and the hospital immediately tries to get rid of them. So what you get is the hospitals can no longer self-improve the way a business can. They're just constantly worried about the malpractice exposure, and anyone who tries to improve a hospital gets fired. Get them out of there, because they can become a witness in a malpractice case. And so if you have a doctor who writes on notes and says, this patient's not being taken care of, and he writes that down, he's at risk of being fired because of malpractice exposure, because all these hospitals are living in fear of malpractice cases, and they get judgments. I mean, I just heard recently about a hospital in Jamestown, New York, had a $20 million malpractice judgment against it. I mean, the administrators of these hospitals are just living in fear constantly of these huge malpractice awards. And you get a doctor on staff who tries to improve things, get rid of them. That's one problem. Another problem is you get patients who try to enhance a malpractice case against a doctor by setting the doctor up or by getting criminal charges brought against the doctor. We've seen a couple cases where the patient will try to get criminal charges brought against the doctor so that he can get convicted of something, and then they can file a malpractice case and get a malpractice award. So malpractice starts to spill into the criminal justice system and starts to corrupt the criminal justice system. Because if you can get a criminal conviction against a doctor, then the malpractice case is that much easier. In fact, the malpractice case becomes a slam dunk if the doctor gets convicted criminally. And I've seen a number of cases like that. Sometimes the hospital will find a scapegoat for a medical problem just to avoid the $20 million malpractice lawsuit. We got a case down in Florida of Alan Yurko. This fellow brought in his 10-week-old son to the hospital, and his son died. And when you get an infant who's 10 weeks old and dies at the hospital, that's a $10 million malpractice case. And what hospitals learn to do to protect themselves is they learn to look for a scapegoat. And increasingly, when you get an infant who dies at that age, they start to say, well, you know, maybe the parents abused this kid. No, it's not our fault. Parent killed this kid. Shaken baby syndrome. And this fellow serving life in jail because he was charged with shaken baby syndrome. And what was probably just malpractice by the doctors of the hospital. They look for a scapegoat, stick it on somebody else. This is the way the game's played now. And then finally, the final distortion, which is what I spoke about 2 years ago here, the World Trade Center. What happened there? Well, I spoke about how I'm from the New York area and how those buildings collapsed prematurely. They withstood the impact of the airplanes. People were evacuating. We have friends who knew the people who were evacuating. They call up on their cell phone, okay, I'm walking out. Firefighters run into the building, and the whole thing collapses. Well, what happened there? Well, my suggestion 2 years ago was that the building was not fireproofed adequately. It was a fire trap. And the reason it was a fire trap was because while they were building it, there was a litigation scare. And they planned to fireproof the building with asbestos. And there became a scare that asbestos would lead to all this litigation and that the city would be sued because people would be inhaling asbestos that was put in the building, so they just took the asbestos out. And they just finished the building without asbestos. And therefore, the building didn't have adequate fireproofing, and it collapsed due to the fire. Well, we're 2 years later, and we've got a 9/11 commission that's supposed to look into this, and they're supposed to figure this out. Why'd the building collapse? That's one of their jobs. Well, they came to New York last month, and they held public hearings for 2 days in New York, which is not very long for a commission that's been spending millions of dollars on this. And the first thing they did for the public hearings is said, okay, we're going to exclude all firefighters. We're not going to let any firefighters testify at this public hearing. Unbelievable. Firefighters' unions complained about that bitterly. They were all excluded. So then they bring in Giuliani to testify. And of course, Giuliani was man of the year, and he was lionized for his role in bolstering public confidence after the attacks, and really probably the most popular person in New York for, you know, last 10 years. He comes in and testifies, but the room is filled with these victims of 9/11. And they start lobbing softball questions at Giuliani, and they start praising him. The commission, oh, you did such a great job, Giuliani. Meanwhile, the family's victims, they had their own questions. They post on the website, you know, these are questions we'd like to see asked about this. Like one question is, why did Building 7 collapse when it wasn't even hit? Three buildings collapsed. The two towers, but there was another World Trade Center building that collapsed that wasn't even hit. It collapsed from the heat. That's how bad the fireproofing was. It just collapsed from the heat. And they had a list of questions. I was wondering, you know, why did it collapse and wasn't even hit? We want to see that question asked, public hearing. Nah, they're not going to ask that. They're lobbing these softball questions to Giuliani. And the crowd at the hearing, I don't know if you read about this, but the families, you know, they start to get outraged. They start to heckle Giuliani. They got posters. They're waving posters in the crowd. See, I got some of them here. Here we go. One woman who lost a family member, she's holding up a placard that just says lies. Picked up by the cameras. Here's someone whose firefighter son died in the Trade Center. Quote, my son was murdered because of your incompetence, she shouted. Here's another, a widow, after the hearing. Today was a joke, close quote, talking about the question of Giuliani. Families, victims talked about the lost opportunity. Here's another. Here's someone's husband died in the South Tower. Quote, we leave frustrated, close quote. Quote, they made a huge faux pas in letting Rudy Giuliani polish his crown, close quote. So then they asked Giuliani what he thought about all this. He says, quote, "I knew that that would happen. I attribute it to the stress and the trauma that they're going through." In other words, he blames the victims' families. Well, what's really going on here? It's the commission's not going to do anything that exposes the government to liability in this thing. They're not going to admit the thing was a fire trap. Then you're going to get billions of dollars in lawsuits. They're going to cover it up. Everyone's afraid of litigation. It's another distortion caused by the litigation epidemic. The fact that asbestos was taken out of the building, that was caused by the litigation epidemic. Okay, what can be done about it? What can be done about this problem? This is the most difficult aspect of the issue, and I'll open it up to questions and comments afterwards. But let's consider, first of all, some of the proposals that have presented, and let's ponder whether they would really work. One proposal is let the insurance companies try to take care of this. Well, insurance companies are not doing such a good job as it is. They're all loss limited by their policies. So they don't, you know, they can just adjust the amount of coverage they give, and that's it. They're protected. There's a $20 million award against a hospital. The insurance company may just insure them for a couple million dollars, and that's it. The rest has to be paid by the hospital. There is a proposal to put caps on awards. This has happened in Texas. They passed an amendment to the Constitution that allows the legislature to impose absolute caps, $250,000. You get injured, you can't recover more than $250,000. Usually it's phrased in terms of non-economic damages, like pain and suffering. That's the most you can get, $250,000. We've had that in California for probably 30 years. Illinois too. Malpractice, there's a cap. You can't recover more than that.
Only
in medical malpractice. Well, in Texas, you know how those legislatures left Texas? You know, the Democrats left the state and everything. I mean, there's some serious politics going on in Texas, and the Republican legislators, they just passed across the board everything. They got a cap for everything down there. Med-Mal, everything else, product liability. However, in the states that have done this, we haven't seen that big of an effect. West Virginia just passed one of these, for example. It didn't cause the insurance premiums to go down for doctors. Not at all. So it's not clear that this is really going to help that much, the caps. You know, if you have a $250,000 cap, I mean, you still have to defend the lawsuit. You still have to get malpractice insurance. Maybe that's just a benefit for the insurance company and not really for the doctor. It's unclear. That doesn't seem to be doing the job. In California, the governor proposed, why don't we let the state get a piece of this action? So when there's a big punitive award, why don't we let the state of California grab a portion of that award? And that way we can try to balance our budget with this litigation crisis. So, I mean, instead of solving litigation crisis, let's try to turn it to our benefit. Then we can increase the size of government, and the government will then be built on litigation. It's sort of like those tobacco settlements. It's like, you know, first it was like the tobacco companies are evil. Then the states are like, well, let's cut a deal with the tobacco companies. Then we'll get all their money, and, you know, now they're not so bad anymore. Now it's like the state's like dependent on tobacco. So same thing here. It's like the governor's saying, well, let's get the state to grab these punitive damages awards. So then we're going to have the state dependent on the litigation epidemic. So then if we really solve litigation epidemic, the state would go bankrupt. So I don't know. I don't think that's going anywhere. Another proposal is to limit attorney's fees and say, well, let's make it so that an attorney can't make more than 20% on contingency. Or the attorney can make 33% but can't make more than $100,000 or something. Well, the problem with that is basically now you got the state in the business of regulating private contracts and regulating people's wages. And, you know, if that gets too popular, next thing you know, they're going to be saying, well, why don't we just put caps on how much CEOs make, too? Because companies are ripping off people, so if we just put a cap on how much CEOs make, then we'll solve that problem. And why don't we put a cap on how much doctors can make? You know, and so on right down the line. That seems to be a bit of a dangerous precedent to set with the wage, with the government setting limits on how much people can make. Plus, it's not likely to be passed. I mean, it's not something that I think is necessarily popular with the public. And I don't know it would solve the problem either. So what can we do? What'd you say?
Shoot the lawyer.
Well, that was close. I thought you said something else. But just change your conscience there and say, sue the lawyers. Sue the lawyers, which is what a doctor has done in West Virginia. Dr. Julie McCammon, after she endured two frivolous malpractice actions, she said, I've had enough. I'm suing the West Virginia Trial Lawyers Association. And I'm suing them for conspiring to bring all these lawsuits against me and everybody else. And I'm going to hold them accountable for this crisis. I mean, go right to the source. They're suing us. Well, I'm going to sue them and expose what they're doing. Well, it's a very interesting case, and she got her first judge out there in West Virginia. And by the way, West Virginia is the capital litigation epidemic in this country. I mean, that's the place where they go in and they get multi-million dollar and multi-billion dollar judgments against asbestos companies. I mean, there is not much else going on in West Virginia but these. You know, God bless the state, but it's a couple beautiful federal highways that Senator Byrd, who's been in the Senate 40 or 50 years, has procured because of his powerful position in the Senate, and it's like a ton of litigation. The lawyers run the state. All right, so she gets before the first judge, and it comes out that the first judge, 9 years ago, this doctor delivered his wife's baby. So they're all over that. They're saying, oh, you got to recuse yourself. You know, the lawyers whom she's suing, they said, no, you got to, judge has stepped down because 9 years ago the doctor delivered his wife's first baby. So he steps down. All right, so then they get a replacement judge. Well, the plaintiff, Dr. Julie McCammon, she finds out that the replacement judge, his wife, belongs to the West Virginia Trial Lawyers Association. She's a member of the entity that she's suing. So she's, you got to step down. You can't, you know, you're married to someone who belongs to the defendant. You got to recuse. Well, he said, why don't I run this up to the West Virginia Supreme Court and see what they say about that? So he asked the West Virginia Supreme Court, and what do you know? They come back and say, no, no problem. No problem at all. You can handle this. There's no conflict there. So he takes the case, and she schedules these depositions of the West Virginia Trial Lawyers Association, and she asks for their documents on their website. They don't turn anything over. They don't give her any information on the website. They give her a few meaningless things. She's got the deposition all set up of their president. Just before time for that comes, I think there was a postponement or two. Then they move for dismissal of the case, so he never has to get deposed. Judge grants dismissal of the case. So I stepped in, and I've now taken this on appeal to the West Virginia Supreme Court for her, and we're saying, you got to overturn this. You got to give us a new judge. And furthermore, I found a couple cases where the trial lawyers sued trade associations in other industries and recovered against them. For example, they sued a trade association manufacturers claiming that the trade association covered up the bad effects of asbestos, and therefore the trade association is liable for this. And they won. So I said, look, you know, if lawyers can do this against trade associations, other industries, the trade association of lawyers, they're accountable too. And if they're training people to bring these frivolous cases, and if they're putting out misinformation and so on, they should be accountable just like everybody else. No, don't have class. Yeah, you all want to join? So their attorney writes back in reply, and he says, well, wait a minute. In asbestos, there's no dispute that asbestos is killing all these people, hundreds of thousands of people. I mean, that's different. I mean, we all know that asbestos is like, there is no dispute about that. Well, actually, there is a big dispute about that. But us attorneys, I mean, we haven't heard anybody. Well, Professor Lester Brickman, who studied the litigation epidemic, and he came up with a term for it. He calls these attorneys who bring these suits, and particularly in the asbestos area, he refers to them as the malignant enterprise. And he says, handling this case in West Virginia, he says that's like the Christians countersuing the Romans before they got fed to the gladiators. So let's see what happens. We don't have a ruling yet. All right, but that's one approach, to sue them and hold them accountable. Hold them accountable for the courses they teach, the training. These lawyers are trained. This is a big enterprise, bringing these suits. And the experts and the doctors, there should be accountability for the people who are training these experts to go into court and try to inflate these judgments. We're training people to go in how to pick juries and stuff. Let's get some accountability here. Second approach is something that's known as, quote, going bare, close quote. Not too many of you may be familiar with that concept, but it basically means you get rid of your insurance. You look at your assets, you get your assets squared away with your spouse or your kids or whatever, and you say, come on and sue me. There's no money here. Bring it on. Spend a couple $100,000. There's no money here. Now, doctors who have done this have been very successful. And they'll tell their patients. New patient come in their office. They'll tell their patients, say, listen, I'd love to treat you. I just got to tell you one thing. I have no insurance. Doesn't bother me. I don't expect it to bother you. But just be aware of that. Most patients don't care. They say, That's fine. You know, most patients are not looking to see their doctor. It's a small minority of patients who are bringing these lawsuits. And so if one of those patients has a problem and the patient changes his mind and wants to sue, first thing that attorney's going to find out is the doctor has no insurance. You think that attorney is going to invest $100,000 in that case? Not likely. It's the insurance that's feeding a lot of the problem. Insurance companies are deep pockets. You take away that deep pocket, a lot of the problem goes away. Now, not everybody's comfortable with that. Some attorneys advise against it. But doctors I know who have done it, they're thrilled with it. They think it's great. And I'll tell you, as a patient myself, I'm fine going into a doctor and having an arrangement where he knows I'm not going to sue him. I think that's better for my care, to be honest with you. You know, he's not going to always be wondering whether I'm going to sue him. He's not going to be ordering tests because he's afraid I might sue him. He's not going to be doing things to avoid a lawsuit. It's, you know, old-fashioned doctor-patient relationship. I mean, why is it such a bad thing? Or bill, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I know, and here's the other thing. This is the other reason why I'd like to go to a doctor who's gone bare. Doctors who are sued, my brother was sued for malpractice. I mean, I could see how stressed out he was about it. And he eventually won. But it is stressful being sued. Now, when I go to see a doctor, I don't want him thinking about his deposition next week or his, you know, his testimony. I want to be thinking about me. And they've done studies. They say the stress of being sued is comparable to having an immediate family member pass away. That's a comparable level of stress for the average person. So, you know, it's like, you want to see a doctor who's facing one or two malpractice suits and have that stress over hanging over his head when you're trying to get an honest answer and trying to get care from? No, I don't. This is sort of the free enterprise approach to the problem, and I think this has the most promise. Basically, develop a system outside of the malpractice crisis. Use private contracting so that people who don't profit from the litigation epidemic can find doctors and others who want to step outside of the system too, and you just create an economic unit outside of the problem. And you can do that by private contract. You can agree to your doctor not to sue him. Doctor can go bare. Not much anybody can do about that. All right, let's open up to questions.
There's a problem with that in California because most hospitals will not allow doctors to have staff privileges to admit patients who do not have malpractice insurance. So what's the solution to that?
The solution is to start to get strong enough where you can start to educate the hospitals as they're doing in Florida. Florida had the same thing, and the number of people who were going bare started to get big enough in numbers that the hospitals started to drop it as a requirement. So you have to get a certain critical mass in order to persuade the hospitals to do it. Now, not all doctors need hospital privileges either, and there are a lot of doctors who have specialties that don't need hospital privileges. There are other doctors who have developed their own clinics outside of the hospital, their own surgery centers or whatever. Not everyone has the luxury of doing that. Question in the back.
How do we stop the ACLU from collecting these big legal costs that they've incurred bringing some crummy suit?
Yeah. Well, that's right. There's a provision that was put into federal law after Watergate that allows the ACLU and others like it to collect their legal fees when they win a lawsuit to remove the Ten Commandments somewhere or anything else under the Constitution. That's in federal law that requires them to recover their attorney's fees. So, again, you sort of have to follow the money in this litigation epidemic and realize what's feeding these things. And the reason there are all these lawsuits by the ACLU over the Ten Commandments and related things, because they're getting paid at the end. They're getting paid when they win. Howard.
To follow the money, would you favor legislation that would prohibit all punitive damage awards?
Well, yeah, I might. Yeah. I might. Now, sort of ask yourself why that hasn't happened. you know, why haven't companies that you would think have more power than anybody gone into their state legislatures and lobbied for abolishing punitive damages? They can do that. And the position of several Supreme Court justices, notably Justice Thomas, was that don't look at me to limit these outrageous punitive damage awards. Go to your state legislature and get them to limit them or abolish them. But what happens, these companies, you get the people who are in control of their lobbying and their political money, and they end up aligning themselves with the trial attorneys, and they're not even acting in the best interest of the companies anymore. And it's like the insurance companies, too. I mean, I don't think these corporations and insurance companies can be relied upon to solve the epidemic, because they're basically, they've demonstrated over the past couple of decades that they're not going to do anything about it. And you know what they do? You know, insurance, I mean, ask yourself, if there's a $10 million punitive damage award against a company, against McDonald's, or against a doctor, does that hurt the insurance company? Not necessarily. They may like the publicity, and they just hike their premiums. They get all that press, and they say, oh, look at this, and they just hike their premiums 20% across the board. I mean, that may be good for their business, for all I know. So, I mean, we got to do this ourselves. Yeah. Yeah. Like in England, that's a good question. It said, how about... Yeah. How about requiring the plaintiff to pay the defendant's legal costs if the defendant wins? Now, in most malpractice cases, the defendant does win. Although it used to be like 70% of the time, it's getting down to about 50% of the time now. And if the plaintiffs had to pay that cost, then that would deter a lot of frivolous cases. So I think that's a good idea. Now, you can do that by contract. And what doctors should consider doing is handing their patient as part of the 15 forms the patients sign anyway when they first go to the doctor's office. You know, what's one more line that says, oh, by the way, if you sue me and you lose, you pay my attorney's fees. That should be enforceable without any trouble at all. And that's, yeah, I support that completely. Yeah, ma'am. Well, I got the trial attorneys defend the McDonald's case. You can go to the National Trial Attorney Association at law. You go to the website, and they got like this full defense of McDonald's and everything. And right off the website, they say that between 1982 and 1992, 10 years, there were more than 700 claims by people burned by coffee at McDonald's. That's only 7 people a year. Now, McDonald's, how many cups of coffee do they serve? 1 million a year? Maybe more? Maybe 10 million? Do we all have to now have colder coffee because there are few people who want to drive while they're mixing their cream and sugar coffee? I have to differ with you on that. Look, you know, you're going to sit there in the car and you're going to... And this woman, you know, yeah, she burned herself, but you know what? Coffee is hot. I mean, it's hot.
Why aren't
you know?
There more melted tongues? That's what I want to
know. The question is, what about all these lawyers who serve in lawmaking bodies? Maybe we should abolish the ability of lawyers to serve in the legislature. My profession is dominated by liberals. I mean, it's to find a conservative attorney is like finding a needle in a haystack. I mean, you show me an attorney, 9 times out of 10, this is the guy who thinks the government should be handing out more entitlements, you know, thinks that there should be more wealth redistribution, and so right down the list. And it's fine with me to keep him out of the legislatures. Yeah. Okay, just to repeat that, California has had caps on what you can recover for non-economic or pain and suffering damages. And California's malpractice premiums that doctors have to pay are significantly lower than the rest of the country. That is all true. And it may be that that's the reason. There may be other reasons. California is not as dominated by attorneys as some other states are. Well, listen, all states are dominated, but... You know, you got a Hollywood guy in the governor's office. You know, you got all these other colorful politicians in California. You got Hollywood. You got Silicon Valley. You have a massive defense industry out here. You've got shipping. This is not a one-industry state the way that West Virginia is, the way that Southern Illinois is, the way that Mississippi is. So it's hard to say. I think it's helped here in California. Passing the caps in other states has not brought about the same relief that you see here in California. So it's a bit of a mystery. I mean, everyone's trying to imitate California, but the doctors are telling me that when they pass the caps, nothing changes. My view is the only thing that's going to solve this is free enterprise. That's the only thing that solves any economic problem is free enterprise. And I urge you to go the route of free enterprise, and let's build an economic system outside of the litigation epidemic and watch that litigation epidemic and everyone who belongs to it go bankrupt, and we'll be doing fine outside of it. So thank you very much.